in the digital sand.
Yeah, I sent some tweets in 2014 and ended up getting a 12-week prison sentence for those tweets.
It wasn't her habit to abuse people online, but today, Isabella Sorley is known as one of England's most notorious trolls. So, what was Isabella's online offense? In 2013, feminist activist Carolyn Criado Paris was campaigning to have a woman's face appear on the next printing of the English £10 note. The public reaction was largely positive, but she was also deluged by a torrent of abusive, irrational, and threatening messages on Twitter. Isabella joined that mob.
That particular night, I was incredibly drunk, and I decided to go home and just send tweets. It wasn't about the campaign. I don't overly care what's on a British banknote. I know she was campaigning to have a woman, and the Queen's on the banknote anyway, so I don't... I did really not care at all what she was campaigning about. Even now, I don't even know why I sent them. I would love to know why, and I'd love to give, like, a clear answer, but the real thing is that I was drunk, and I've just jumped on the bandwagon and followed a lot of other people.
The trolls were not debating. They were spewing hate and attacking Criado Perez personally for her feminist agenda. Isabella added 6 threatening tweets of her own. She threatened rape and worse.
I woke up in the morning, like, obviously worse for wear, realised what I'd done. I was physically sick. I don't know if it was down to the tweets or just the hangover. Like, absolutely vile. Like, what I tweeted was disgusting, so... To think that I actually typed that out, I felt disgusted in myself that I'd sent those specific words to another person.
Filled with remorse the night after spewing her online hate, Isabella took to the internet to both confess and say sorry.
I apologised to her, went, look, it is an empty threat, do not worry, I'm sorry. I don't know if it reassured her at all, but kind of it made me feel a little bit better that yeah, she's getting all these other rape and death threats. At least mine is an empty threat. She doesn't have to worry about me falling through with what I said.
But rape and death threats are taken very seriously. 4 months later, Isabella was arrested along with another troll. Her trial was widely publicized and she faced the scorn of a nation.
I got a 12-week prison sentence in Holloway Prison. Hard. It was really hard because obviously, like, how high profile it was, I couldn't hide away. I had all the prisoners asking why I did it. I had all, like, the prison guards asking why I did it. I was getting a lot of abuse from everywhere. I was being made out to be a woman hate, and then obviously I'm in a women's prison, so I was like, oh dear, now you got my head kicked in because of what someone had saw, what I'd tweeted on the news. I saw myself on Crime Watch in the prison cell, so that was hard.
After her time in jail, Isabella was ordered to do community service and also pay money to Caroline Criado Perez personally for her online attacks.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, slander. Few sins can be found among the capital sins that indicate meanness, weakness, humiliation, and cowardice like slander does. Slanderers falsely blame and ascribe faults to others and damage reputations to satiate the fire of their envy and malice. They are weak and mean persons who do not have the courage to confront their victims with their baseless and unfair criticisms and can only stab others in the back. It is mentioned in one of the traditions that even if a slanderer repents and the repentance is accepted, he shall be the last one entering paradise. Otherwise, he would be the first one entering the hell. So see how Islam is looking at this disease, the spiritual disease of slander. Unfortunately, in today's society, when it comes to slandering other people, when it comes to defamation of other people, when it comes to lying and portraying and painting a false and wrong picture of someone else, all of these things are considered to be normal. Why? Because every other person is doing it. Well, guess what? Islam doesn't want you to become every other person. Islam wants you to be that ideal person that Allah wants you to be. This is what Prophet and Ahlul Bayt want to see in you, that amongst everyone, doesn't matter the entire world become, you know, slanderer, you protect your spirituality, you protect your ethics, you protect your morals. This is the expectation of Allah and Islam from you. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we're discussing slander. We don't like it, but we see it very often in our societies. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, slander is the last effort of weak people. One of the greatest and most dangerous in the meantime, most popular corruptions of tongue is slander. Slander indicates mentioning hidden weak points and faults of others so that if they hear, they will be disturbed. These points are either concerned with religious, moral, spiritual, and social aspect, or with the corporeal aspects, including face, bodies, limbs, you know, corporal powers, and actions and behaviors, and his attachment, such as wife, child, or his clothing, house, etc. So slander, you know, once we study about it in the ethical and moral teachings of Islam, we see that its range is pretty wide. It's not something that is very confined to you just, you know, doing this one thing is considered to be slander. No. If you look at the details of what slander encapsulates and includes, you would be surprised to see that, God forbid, you know, it's more common than what we think it to be. So slander is a spiritual disease, you know, this ability and capability of slandering others, you know, This is something that is a spiritual disease, and hence it has spiritual treatments too. Just like a doctor treats a physical disease, a spiritual doctor, which is Prophet Ahlul Bayt and the ulama and scholars of akhlaq, they treat these spiritual ailments and diseases. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families who, disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year is being very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition.
Les négociations ont été très difficiles.
The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel. Something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takrabanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takrabanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
Yemeni scholars came together in the capital Sana'a to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said that with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public and the Muslim world, with pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
In each of the 27 EU nations, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will start being used in less than a week's time, on the 27th of December. The European Medicines Agency has given its approval and has played down concerns that the new highly contagious COVID-19 variant spreading in England will not respond to the vaccine.
These are issues that need to be fully scientifically assessed. At the moment, we can say that there is no evidence to suggest that the vaccine will not work against the new variant of the coronavirus.
The UK is now isolated as countries around the world impose travel restrictions due to the new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. There has been travel chaos for millions. People have been trying to get out of the UK before travel bans are enforced. There is major disruption at the main trading corridors between the UK and EU. Global markets have been in disarray due to the deepening health crisis in Europe.
Rather than waiting for other countries to make the first move, epidemiologists are saying the British government should have done the responsible thing and blocked all non-essential travel from the UK.
We have been getting reactions from members of the public in Brussels.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
It's a new thing, we don't know what it is, but we need to act, I think, faster, and maybe in the beginning a little bit harder.
If government imposed like that strict lockdown like they did in South Korea or like North Korea and China, I think there will be riots here.
The European Medicines Agency says it is currently in contact with 46 vaccine developers, and it expects to approve the Moderna jab on the 6th of January. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better, but you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a date, a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government, but no more promises we'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. Who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would urge people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they had been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way, kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Can you download an HD movie in 1 second? Thanks to 5G internet? Yes. While around 50 countries have already launched the fifth generation broadband service, Iran is also jumping on the wagon to roll out the high-speed internet network. Iran's Science and Technology Vice Presidency says 5G coverage will for now be available in the country's Kish Island and will soon reach other regions.
We can now say that Iran is one of the first countries that stepped into this modern technology. We have built the needed infrastructure in Kish Island and at the same time are working on major locations such as Tehran to roll out the technology.
Iran successfully tested 5G in July when users reported a 1.5 gigabit per second of download speed on their mobile phones. However, Iran's ST Vice Presidency says 5G for now will not be offered for household applications and will initially be limited to industrial uses, such as smart transportation.
With 5G's low latency, reliability, and powerful connections, we can create an integrated transport network that connects all cars together and also connects personal cars to police for instant guidance and warnings.
Not also in our country, but also most of the countries, 5G infrastructures aren't implemented yet. So we need pass time for implementing these infrastructures, and after that we can use the use cases of 5G.
The deployment of 5G technology is expected to boost Iran's infrastructure for accommodating sensitive online services through domestic servers. Experts say this would significantly increase the cloud computing capacity in the country.
Some 70 million Iranian SIM card owners currently use the third and fourth generation of mobile internet. They still have to wait to see the 5G icon appearing on the top corner of their smartphones. But Iran's ICT officials promised to make 5G internet available for widespread personal use by the end of 2022. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas. But that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January, there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week.
Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test.
Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homolezki, Vienna.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A long and cruel siege. Constant Israeli regime attacks resulting in the killing of countless Palestinians, destruction of their homes and infrastructure. Extreme poverty and trauma remain the daily bread of Palestinians in Gaza, says Miko Pled, writer, in an article published under the heading Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza goes uninterrupted. But is Europe finally taking notice? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A report published by the United Nations in 2018 stated that by the year 2020, the Gaza Strip would be uninhabitable. It said specifically that the United Nations has stated that Gaza may well be unlivable by 2020. The report emphasized also that Michael Legg, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories occupied since 1967, drew attention to the Israeli regime's persistent non-cooperation with the Special Rapporteur's mandate. As with his two predecessors, Israeli regime has not granted him entry to the occupied Palestinian territory. Anyone who thinks that the Gaza Strip was livable prior to 2020 is out of their mind. The Gaza Strip has been a humanitarian disaster in the aftermath of 1948 Zionist campaign of ethnic cleansing, It was created primarily as a holding place for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians driven off their lands by Zionist terrorists in southern Palestine. Impoverished and homeless, these refugees were forced to survive on handouts, and today they make up more than half of the Gaza Strip's 2.2 million inhabitants. Now 2020 has come and gone. The United Nations report is shelved, and not a thing has changed. Over 2 million people remain imprisoned by the Zionist regime in the Gaza Strip. They suffer from a lack of the most basic needs like drinkable water, electricity, medicine, and nutrition. A delegation of European representatives recently visited Gaza, yet Europeans have not used their influence, political or otherwise, to end the Israeli regime's violation of human rights and international law. It would not have taken much for EU representatives to see the devastation, poverty, and severe shortages experienced by the people of Gaza. All one needs to do is drive through the Gaza Strip to see the evidence, and yet no change seems to be forthcoming from the Europeans. In fact, according to the Zionist press, Germany just announced that in order to provide the Zionist regime with a European-made vaccine for COVID-19, Germany used its influence in the EU to bend the rule that the European-produced vaccination would be given to European countries first. Germany justified the decision in part through its historical commitment to supporting the Israeli regime. Knowing full well that millions of Palestinians are denied health care and that the spread of COVID-19 among Palestinians is alarming, no such commitment was made to assist the Palestinians in their fight against the deadly disease. The comfort that Europeans display as they cooperate with the Zionist regime, even as they claim to be champions of human rights, amounts to complicity. According to the Geneva Convention, particularly the Rome Statute, European cooperation with the Israeli regime constitutes complicity in genocide. When one looks at the definition of genocide and compares it with the actions of the Zionist regime in Gaza, it is quite clear that the Zionist state is engaged in genocide. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such, killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Three of the five examples given here are constantly committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza. Furthermore, Article 2 of the Genocide Convention contains a narrow definition of a crime of genocide, which includes two main elements, one of which is the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. Israeli regime attacks on Gaza for over 7 decades clearly demonstrate that they are part of a larger strategy and that there is clear intent to bring about the destruction of a people. According to a report published by Human Rights Watch, HRW, the issue of complicity with genocide is quite clear. Prior jurisprudence has defined the term complicity as aiding and abetting, instigating and procuring complicity to commit genocide in Article 2, 3E refers to all acts of assistance or encouragement that have substantially contributed to or have had a substantial effect on the completion of the crime of genocide. The report defined the following as elements of complicity in genocide. Complicity by procuring means such as weapons, instruments, or any other means used to commit genocide, with the accomplice knowing that such means would be used for such a purpose. Complicity by knowingly aiding or abetting a perpetrator of a genocide in the planning or enabling acts thereof. According to that definition, both the EU states and the United States are complicit in the crime of genocide. Human Rights Watch maintains that the Zionist regime has entrenched discriminatory systems that treat Palestinians unequally. It involves systematic rights abuses, including collective punishment, routine use of excessive lethal force against protesters, and prolonged administrative detention without charge or trial for hundreds. It continues to state that Israel builds and supports illegal settlements, expropriating Palestinian land and imposing burdens on Palestinians but not on settlers, restricting their access to basic services and making it nearly impossible for them to build. Regarding the Gaza Strip, HRW writes that Israeli regime's more than decade-long closure of Gaza severely restricts the movement of people and goods, with devastating humanitarian impact. The first order of business needs to be the immediate and unconditional lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007. A no-fly zone monitored by UN or European naval forces must be imposed on all Israeli regime aircraft. In addition to these measures, humanitarian relief must be made available to the people of Gaza without delay. The Zionist regime must be sanctioned, and all military and economic cooperation with the regime must be stopped until such time that it complies with international law and ends all its violations of human rights. This should be followed by setting a date for free and fair one-person, one-vote elections in all of historic Palestine. Then processes must be put in place for repatriation of Palestinian refugees, and funding must be set aside for payment of repatriations and restitution. The Zionist regime must also be held accountable for its violations of international law since 1948, and Israeli regime politicians as well as military commanders must be investigated and charged with war crimes. European countries are fully aware of the reality that exists in Gaza. A long and cruel siege, constant Israeli attacks, resulting in the killing of countless civilians, destruction of homes and infrastructure, extreme poverty and trauma are the daily bread of Palestinians in Gaza. The reality in Gaza is no secret, and the Zionist regime violations of international law are well known. However, European regimes are in the habit of seeing colonized and formerly colonized people as needing aid and doing little to provide the aid. In the case of the Gaza Strip, real political action is called for, but it is not clear if and when the EU will be willing to act.
Iran Today.
The West attempts to busy Iran with more negotiations to limit its potentials. No, to further limit its potentials. The JCPOA was inked in 2015 between Iran and world powers. It was a deal to ease UN sanctions on this country in return for Iran to restrict its peaceful nuclear program. Iran did so, but nothing happened. Well, this country did gain the trust of the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog. Also, the trust of Europe, or so it would seem. When the US pulled out of the JCPOA in May 2018, the EU enacted an updated blocking statute. That was to nullify US sanctions against countries trading with Iran. Europe itself, however, hasn't really been trading with Iran since, and Iran understood. Perhaps Europe wasn't powerful enough to pull it off. But come December 2020, Maus, the German foreign minister, dropped a bomb. I'm Leila Faramarzi. Iran thought it had at least won trust in the innocence of its nuclear technological advancement. But Heiko Maus said early this month, "We distrust Iran." And there it was, plain and simple, staring Iran in the face all along. But that is exactly why the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was signed in the first place, to gain trust by coming to an understanding. Instead, Europe is echoing America in asking for more, for a JCPOA plus. But Iran doesn't have to renegotiate a done deal. Now, does Iran risk the wrath of a united Western Front? Or is Europe losing all in inching for a little more? Let's begin with the expert opinion of Mr. Yazdan Panah, professor of geopolitics.
The Europeans are telling the Americans that we have the power and we can be decisive. They are actually sending this message to the United States and not to Iran. They saw we are world-class actors. This is a rule known in the international system. It's true that the influential European countries are playing the American geopolitical game in all the major global competitions, especially against emerging powers like China, India, and even Russia. We shouldn't take Europeans' words too seriously in this matter. We need to see who is operating that pressure lever and how we can get rid of that pressure, which always ends with the US.
Germany holds the EU presidency now, and its foreign minister's remarks calling for an agreement beyond the UN Security Council followed the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist. So it's pretty sore when it says Iran is not to be trusted, when the obvious culprits of the assassination are the westernmost superpower, the US and Israel. Israeli Premier Netanyahu did say in recent years, in his attempt at proving Iran's nuclear program is military, to remember the name Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, as if putting a target on his back. Obligations the West has breached by contract could mean many a loss to the continent that is an extension of Asia. Europe is the immediate neighbor of West Asia and therefore depends on Iran as a front against terrorism leaking into its territory. In other words, Europe needs Iran's alliance to boost its own security. And now it is bent on breaching the JCPOA for more negotiations. Iran is not going to get distracted from its goals anymore. With the US withdrawal in 2018, Iran started stepping back from its nuclear commitments. And now its parliament has recently passed a bill titled Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions Following the Death of Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian parliament members set a deadline of 1 or 2 months, noting that if the European and American parties do not return to their commitments under the JCPOA and do not take strategic action to lift sanctions, Iran would withdraw from the additional protocol and resume enrichment. This is just a law to be implemented in the future. The law won't be implemented anytime soon. Despite the approval of the Guardian Council, the government has not yet taken action because there is no need to act hastily. There is a shift in power in the United States, but the atmosphere in America is still unclear. It's possible that the new U.S. administration will come to the realization that the previous administration took the wrong actions and decide to return to the JCPOA, albeit conditionally and partially. In my opinion, this conditional return to the JCPOA is also a positive step. In that case, we can move the negotiations forward based on what we want.
Mr. Mousavi is an MP with strong feelings on the JCPOA. Here's what he said.
We all agreed with the totality of the plan. I think it was a big step in the parliament in defending the rights of the Iranian people. But I think we should have withdrawn from the additional protocol immediately. Mr. Biden will take office within the 2 months deadline we have set. He's expected to give some initial positive signals when he enters the Oval Office. This causes us to lose a golden opportunity. On the other hand, had we withdrawn from the additional protocol immediately after the approval of the parliament, no one could have accused us of doing so whilst Biden was coming to power. We would also have the upper hand in case the government was to engage with the JCPOA signatories. They could have used the Trump card to say, fulfill your obligations, so we would return to the additional protocol, which we were voluntarily implementing.
It's not just about Fakhrizadeh the man. He was a national asset and was assassinated less than a year since the assassination of General Soleimani and companions by the U.S. in Iraq. Also, the JCPOA laid bare to supposed nuclear inspectors its scientists and state secrets. And this is when the deal hadn't even boosted this country's oil sales and economy. It's understandable how many in Iran believe the government should have taken stronger action against Trump's JCPOA exit. Even Joe Biden, vice president to former Democratic U.S. President Obama, who signed the deal with Iran, is talking of returning to that nuclear deal as a prelude to further negotiations. It was lack of U.S. commitment to the deal that handed Iran's parliament exactly to the very enemies of the JCPOA in the first place, the principalists, that is.
Perhaps the most important thing claiming compensation is that Iran's commitments must return to how they were before. Tehran was honoring its commitments for years and was expecting the West to do the same. The main reason why the Islamic Republic of Iran entered into the negotiations on the nuclear issue was to lift sanctions. We fulfilled all our obligations under the JCPOA, but they did not honor any of theirs. Naturally, when the other side does not lift the sanctions and does not fulfill its obligations, our first task should be going back to square one.
And now, the US and Europe are insisting on renegotiating to scrap Iran's ballistic missile program with any excuse imaginable, say by calling Iran a threat to the region, its own home, that is, the region of West Asia, by bringing up accusations of human rights abuses, referring to the likes of Ruhollah Zam. That's the son of a revolutionary cleric who used social media to denounce alleged state corruption. He was executed days ago on accusation of trying to overthrow the Islamic Republic. This moment, I'd say, is a good time for a quick media review. For a look at other news outlets, I give you Shahrzad.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manjari, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the West's endless anti-Iran ploys and scattered calls for a new deal. Outlook India reports on Trump's toxic legacy in West Asia. As Donald Trump saunters into the sunset of his presidency, unlamented, unhonored, unsung, it is already possible to assess the carnage he is leaving behind, not just in his own country, but in several parts of the world which have experienced the hammer blows of his virulent attention. West Asia is the one region that he gave the most attention to, and it is here that we see the worst aspects of his legacy. After the recent U.S. presidential election results, Two reports have affirmed that the Trump administration's obsession with Iran has not abated. It's been announced that Trump's administration would announce a new sanction on Iran every week till Inauguration Day. It is clear that Trump would like to use his last weeks in the White House to leave his own legacy in the form of poison pills to his successor. Washington Post claims Iran's political establishment faces